Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or at 464-8295 if you're here in the Central Coast of California, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us today Mr. John Perkins, and we're going to be talking about his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Now, what is an economic hitman? Well, economic hitmen are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoff, extortion, sex, and murder. Now, that's quite a statement, but our guest this evening, Mr. John Perkins, worked as an economic hitman for a decade for a major international electric corporation, really left them in 1981, intended to write a book about what he knew, but he didn't. He didn't because he was threatened, he was bribed, everything was done to keep him from revealing the truth about what he knew, being an insider on something he calls the corporatocracy. Mr. Perkins, thank you so much for being with us again this evening.
It's great being with you, Dr. Stan. Jen,
why don't you go ahead and just tell us a little bit about why you didn't write the book, and then, of course, what finally motivated you to write this very, very important book, which exposes the corporatocracy. In fact, why don't you tell our listeners what the corporatocracy is?
Well, that's a good start. The corporatocracy, well, first of all, economic hitmen have really been charged with the responsibility of creating an empire since World War II, and we've done it very successfully. It's the first truly global empire in the history of the world, one that's been created primarily without an army through economics, and one that doesn't have any particular emperor or king. That makes it unique, but the substitute for an emperor or king is really the corporatocracy. And this is a group of men and a few women who basically head up our biggest corporations, our government, and our banks. And they tend to move back and forth between those three pillars of society rather randomly. So it's often hard to know exactly who they're working for. You know, these are people like Robert McNamara, who was president of Ford and then Secretary of Defense under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, and then president of the World Bank. Guys like George Shultz, who was a cabinet minister a couple of times, and president of Bechtel, and then once again Secretary of State under the first Bush presidency, and Dick Cheney, who's been doing very similar things as cabinet positions, and then president of Halliburton, and now vice president. So those are really, that's what comprises the corporatocracy.
And of course we see certainly Condoleezza Rice, formerly with Chevron, now then the head of the National Security, now Secretary of State. They even had an oil tanker named after Condoleezza. You know, it plied in and out of Marxist Angola, carrying oil. And then, of course, when she was appointed to the National Security Council, why, they just renamed the ship. After all, we couldn't have the American people think there was any relationship between the government and Chevron Oil Company. But we'll be back in just a moment with our special guest, Mr. John Perkins. I promise you, this is going to be one of the most interesting programs you've heard in a long time. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Mr. John Perkins, who has lived firsthand almost a secret life. So why don't you just tell our listeners about your background, how you got recruited into the corporatocracy, and of course, what happened when you were recruited?
Well, I was recruited, Dr. Stan, in 1968 while I was still in school. It was my last year in business school in Boston, and I was recruited by the National Security Agency, which is the nation's largest and probably most secretive spy organization. They ran me through a bunch of personality tests and lie detector tests and determined that I was potentially a very good economic hitman, and also they discovered a lot of weaknesses in my character at that time, which they could use to help hook me into this trade. And I think I could summarize those weaknesses as the three primary drugs of our culture, which are money, power, and sex. And not too long after that, I was put through a pretty amazing and extensive training course by a remarkable young woman named Claudine.
And of course, she told you that once you were in, you were in, and you didn't, you had a choice. You didn't have to come in, but if you were in, you were in for life.
Exactly. Claudine knew what my weaknesses were. Those were all in my file. And she was very, very intelligent, very cunning, and very seductive. And she let me know that if I did go in, basically these weaknesses of mine would be satisfied. All the dreams and fantasies I'd had, beginning with her, incidentally, would be satisfied. But she also let me know that what I was getting into was, as she called it, a dirty business. And that once I was in, I would be in for life. I would never be able to get out, and I would never be able to talk about what I'd done. And she said, so don't take your first assignment in Indonesia unless you intend to keep this commitment.
And, of course, what the economic hitman did was to go into the countries and actually encourage the leaders there to take out loans. Why don't you sort of outline how this whole incredible scam works?
Well, yeah, there's a number of different ways that economic hitmen work, depending on the country, Dr. Stan. But if there's a typical one, it goes sort of like this, and that is that we first identify developing countries that have resources that we covet. Often that's oil, or it could be any number of resources. And then we arrange a large loan to that country from the World Bank or a conglomeration of affiliated banks. However, that loan, most of that loan, goes directly to U.S. corporations.
Hold that thought for just a minute. We have to pull the rest of our stations back right onto the network right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Mr. John Perkins. He's the author of the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which is number 10 on the New York Times bestseller list, and it is certainly one of the most fascinating books I've read in a long time. Now, Mr. Perkins was initially recruited by the National Security Agency, that top secret NSA, known as no such agency, because they didn't want the American people to know it existed. Eventually, of course, was sent to this Peace Corps for a three-year stint, and then, of course, recruited into this organization by a very seductive woman who, of course, told him that once he was in for life, and he didn't have to come in. But the purpose of economic hitmen, of course, was to get countries to get tremendously into debt. And Mr. Perkins was saying that basically what they would do would be to go into a country, get that country to borrow a lot of money, but that money then was to be used to fund projects which would be carried out by American corporations, Halliburton, Bechtel, Root, and Brown and Root, other major American corporations, Bechtel Corporation. So the money we were lending was to come back to the United States, but with that came a terrible encumbrance with debt for these third world countries. So why don't you pick up the story there?
Well, you've got it exactly right, Dr. Stan. And once these countries are deeply indebted to us, then we'll go back to them and say, you know, look, you owe us a great deal of money. You can't pay your debts. So sell oil to our oil companies at a very cheap price, or provide land for military bases, or vote with us at the next UN voter, something along those lines. In other words, we demand our pound of flesh at that point. And that's the way we really created the world's first truly global empire, and done so for the most part without the military. And this has all happened essentially since World War II.
And I don't think most people really understand that America has troops in over 130, 140 nations throughout the world. We have a global empire. We are living very well, but at the expense of the impoverished people of third world countries. And they are impoverished not accidentally, not because, you know, they don't want to work, but because we put them into such a situation that in some of the countries they're paying 25% of all of the money that the government takes in simply to service their debt. In other countries like Ecuador, 50% or more of the all the tax revenues are being used to service the national debt. And this is really done intentionally, isn't it?
Yes, it's been a conscious effort since the end of World War II. I think it really grew out of the anxiety and the fear that developed in the first half of the last century from World War I, the Depression in World War II. At the end of World War II, we were left really fearful and wanting to take control of the situation, make sure that those sorts of things never happen again. So in 1944, we got together with a number of other countries and created what had become known as the Bretton Woods Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and their sister organizations. And we did this primarily with a stated objective of helping to reconstruct a world that had been devastated by World War II. And in fact, those organizations did a pretty good job at doing that. However, they also became politicized at an early stage, because in addition to wanting to reconstruct a devastated Europe and Asia, we also wanted to prove that capitalism was superior to the alternative, which was posed by the Soviet Union, communism and socialism. And so from the very beginning, these banks became politicized. Over time, they became more and more politicized, and in the last several decades, they've been used extensively to help the corporatocracy, to help our big corporations become more powerful and richer, and basically to exploit the world, to create an empire where 5% of the world's population, U.S. population, consumes over 25% of the world's resources. And actually, it's even worse than that, Dr. Stan, because of that 5% of the world's population in the United States, 1% of our population, that is to say, 1% of 5% of the world's population controls more than 90% of the resources of this country.
Well, of course, you point out the intense poverty that exists in third world countries, and of course, how things are not getting better for the people there. They're actually getting worse. Do you want to just run by those statistics?
Yeah. In this period from 1960 through the 90s, that the World Bank and the United Nations and the IMF have told us that we've been making progress at eradicating poverty, we've actually... created a situation with much greater poverty and widened the gap between the rich and the poor. In the early 1960s, the ratio of the fifth of the people living, of the income of the fifth of the people living in the wealthiest countries of the world was 30 to 1. By 1995, that ratio had gone to 74 to 1. So that's the ratio of the income of the wealthiest people living in the one-fifth of the world's wealthiest countries to the people living in the one-fifth of the world's poorest countries. That indicates a huge widening of the gap between the rich people of the world and the poor people. We also know that today there's about 24,000 people dying every single day from lack of nutritious food, and over 30,000 children died today and die every day from curable diseases because they don't have the medicines that should be available to them. Now, this is a situation that not only shouldn't happen and is happening because of our neglect, it's actually happening because of our policy of empire building, where we intentionally direct aid that most Americans think is altruistic and going to helping these poor people, we direct that aid to our own corporations and to a few wealthy people in these other countries.
And of course, it's been said that foreign aid is a means by which you take money from poor people in a wealthy country to give to wealthy people in a poor country. And really, of course, what we do is curry favor with the ruling aristocracy in these other countries so that they will use their political power and military power really to enslave their people and funnel contracts to our corporations. Would that be a fair statement?
That's a very fair statement, Dr. Stan, yes.
Now, Chris, for our listeners, I want you to know I believe in the free enterprise system. I believe that there's nothing wrong with capitalism, but it has to be done with compassion, not purely concerned about the bottom line. And when you are intentionally encumbering nations with debt that you know that they will never pay off, that certainly, I think, is totally immoral. And the great tragedy is that, as Mr. Perkins points out, this is not really done, just altruistically at all. It's done with malice aforethought. They know exactly what they're doing, because Mr. Perkins was part and parcel of this. And after a decade or more, why, his conscience got the best of him, and he dropped out. But he didn't write the book for 20 years, from 1981, and I guess he got started right after this September 11th, 2001 attack, didn't you?
Yes. After 9/11, very shortly after 9/11, I went up to Ground Zero, where the World Trade Center had been. And as I stood there looking at that terribly devastated area, I realized that I had to take responsibility for what had happened, and that this was the consequence of the policies that I and others have been implementing throughout the world. I know that there's a tremendous amount of anger in the world. In fact, about 6 or 7 months ago, traveled through Tibet and Nepal and the parts of Europe also, and just last week I was in Brazil and the Caribbean. And one of the things that's very striking as you travel to other countries is how much anger is out there at Americans. I mean, you figure 50,000 people are dying every single day from lack of nutritious food or medicines, things that shouldn't be happening. They're dying terrible, painful deaths. This isn't shown on television, and yet every day a quarter of the amount of people that died in the tsunami die these horrible deaths. And their families are very angry, and the people living in these countries are angry. They know. Some of them can read newspapers. Those who can't can listen to radio stations and hear from word of mouth about that their country has received billions of dollars in foreign aid. Some organizations like the World Bank, and they see that a few families in their countries are getting even more wealthy. They see American companies in there constructing big projects that benefit the wealthy, and they know they're not benefiting at all. In fact, their lives are getting worse. They're very, very angry. And I understood all this after 9/11 as I stood there at Ground Zero in New York City. And I have a 22-year-old daughter. I realized that I have an absolute obligation to her and her generation around the world and their children and grandchildren to speak out. Because what I also realized is that Americans believe this foreign aid is being used altruistically. It isn't. We're being lied to. The wool is being pulled over our eyes. We need to understand what's really going on in the world, and then we need to demand change. And I know that when Americans, who are very compassionate people, truly see what's going on in the world, we will demand change, and we will get it.
Well, I certainly hope so. There's a book called Globalization and Its Detractors by Professor Stiglitz. Now, Professor Stiglitz was hit Nobel Prize in Economics, a chief of the Council of Economic Advisors for President Clinton for 7 years, vice president of the World Bank for 3 or 4 years, and he writes in this book about how all throughout the world, where the International Monetary Fund is lending money, the people are far worse off, and the level of poverty increases the more money we lend them. And then when he left the World Bank, he wrote another book saying the same thing. The World Bank is doing exactly the same thing. after Robert McNamara had spent 10 years as the president of the World Bank. There was an article in Foreign Affairs magazine in the early 1980s stating that Africa was far worse off than before we started lending money, and it didn't make sense. I really couldn't understand it until I read Mr. Perkins' book, and then it's all very obvious. We intentionally got these countries into debt. We bribed or rewarded the ruling elite in those countries to borrow the money, and then, of course, to really enslave the people of that country to pay money that was going to be used then to hire our corporations. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, our guest this evening, Mr. John Perkins, his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. So, you know, as you, of course, write about the various techniques that were used, you use a number of instances where you personally had been involved. So you want to just outline some of those, some of the countries you went into, and what you saw happen, and how this whole scam is utilized to enslave the people?
Well, yes, Dr. Stan, I you know, I personally was involved in a great many countries. I go into detail on some of them in the book, but in Central and South America, I was involved in Guatemala and Panama and Ecuador and Colombia and Argentina, Venezuela. In the Middle East, I've been involved with Iran and Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and a number of other countries, North Africa and Egypt, and in Asia. I was deeply involved in Indonesia there and write extensively about that. I also had a staff of several dozen people who went into many countries. I think it's fair to say that either I or my staff was involved in just about every country in the world that has resources that the United States covets at one time or another. We were involved in those countries.
And, of course, your job was to make it appear that these loans were going to be utilized to help the nation, whereas in your heart you knew that wasn't true.
I did. I knew that we would be helping the rich people in those countries as well as the rich people in this country, the big construction companies and other big companies in the United States. That's what the intent of these loans was, and I did know that in my heart. However, I'll have to say, you know, this whole system is set up in such a way that I did very little that was illegal. A few misdemeanor things down the line, but most of what I did was totally legal.
Well, don't, if you did anything illegal, don't mention it, because you're going to be a target after writing this book.
Well, I'm sure whatever I did that was illegal was well past the statutes of limitations. Those were only misdemeanors. The main work that we do of enticing countries to take loans that they can't repay should be illegal. And it would be if I were to do that to you. If I were a banker and I were to entice you to accept a loan that I knew you couldn't repay because I was looking for a favor from you, I'd be conducting a criminal act. However, when nations do this on an international level, it is not criminal. After all, we write the laws and we make sure it isn't criminal. It should be. But those are the types of things that we were involved in doing.
And, of course, what you point out is the fact that if the economic hitman is not able to get the leaders of the country to, go along with the system, then, of course, more pressure is brought to bear. And, of course, you point out that other type of hitmen come in to take care of the situation. If the leader is altruistic, he wants to help his people, he doesn't want to go along, he doesn't want to indenture them, he really wants to help the common man, why then this man becomes really almost a threat to the system.
That's absolutely true. And this happened from a personal standpoint. I was involved in these sorts of situations in both Panama and Ecuador, where the president of Panama, Omar Torrijos, and the president of Ecuador, Jaime Roldos, refused to accept the bribes, refused to become personally rich, said what they really wanted to do was help the poor people in their country. And it was, in doing so, in the case of Ecuador, rein in the international U.S. oil companies that were exploiting that country, and in the case of Panama, it had a lot to do with the Panama Canal.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to bring our stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Mr. Perkins is saying that he or his staff really were involved in almost every country in the world At one time or another, during that decade or more, he was working for the corporatocracy. Of course, at the time it was for a corporation, International Energy, a corporation, electricity corporation named Maine, which was eventually, of course, bought up by other corporations. But certainly during this period of time, their job was to go into the countries to convince the leaders of the countries to borrow money, which would then be funneled back into our corporations. It would enrich the people in that country. They'd put in very sophisticated highways or dams, or certainly they would put in an electric system, which would, of course, help the people. You know, we're running in industries, but wouldn't help the people in the rural areas ordinarily. They wouldn't be getting the benefits out of this. But, of course, their tax money would be utilized to pay the interest on these massive loans, which have been incurred by the wealthy people in their country for their benefit, not for the benefit of the common men. And then, of course, Mr. Perkins was talking about how he had been involved in Ecuador with the president of that country, and then, of course, in Panama with the president of that country, and both of these men really were concerned about helping the common people, helping to improve their lot in life. And as a result of that, then in come what he refers to as the other type of hitmen, the jackals, the people, the professional assassins who work for the corporatocracy. And what happened to both of those gentlemen?
Both Roldos and Torrijos died in fiery plane helicopter crashes, and they had every sign of being CIA-sanctioned assassinations, in my experience. And in fact, the findings of agencies in Latin America that looked at these came to similar conclusions. Naturally, when our FBI investigated, that's not the conclusion they came to. But there were tremendous signs, and there's incredible numbers of books and articles written about the fact that these were both CIA-sanctioned assassinations. And I personally have very little doubt that that's exactly what happened.
And you wrote they were assassinated because they opposed the fraternity of corporate, government, and banking heads whose goal is global empire. We EHMs, that's economic hitmen, failed to bring Roldos and Torrijos around, and the other type of hitmen, the CIA-sanctioned jackals, who were always right behind us, stepped in. And, of course, you point out that they not only, of course, would assassinate people if they couldn't, that create revolutions or that actually create wars.
That's true. There's many ways that these jackals work to bring down a government that doesn't cooperate with us. And I think it should be pointed out that we have no qualms at all, typically, about bringing down democratically elected presidents if they do not cooperate with the corporations, with the corporatocracy. On the other hand, we have no trouble supporting brutal and bloody dictatorships if they do cooperate with the corporatocracy. I think that's a terrible shame. It goes totally against the principles of the United States. And I believe it goes against what most Americans want to see happen and what most Americans believe should be happening. And that's another reason why I wrote the book, because I think most Americans have no idea that this sort of thing goes on. We need to be aware of it. It goes on all the time. And we need to be aware of it as Americans, and we need to demand something better of our system.
You wrote, and talking about Saddam Hussein, it hardly mattered that he, Saddam, was a pathological tyrant, and that he had the blood of mass murderers on his hands, or that his mannerisms and his brutal actions conjured images of Adolf Hitler. The United States had tolerated and even supported such men many times before. We'd be happy to offer Saddam U.S. government securities in exchange for petrodollars, with a proviso that, of course, those promise that the continued oil supplies, and for a deal whereby the interest on those securities would be used to hire U.S. companies to improve the infrastructure systems throughout Iraq, to create new cities and to turn the desert into oases. But by the late 1980s, it was apparent that Saddam was not buying into the economic hitman scenario. This was a major frustration and a great embarrassment to the first Bush administration, as President George Bush I searched for a way out. Saddam played into his hands. He invaded the oil-rich kingdom of Kuwait. And, of course, we all know what happened then, the first Gulf War. We're going to be back in just a moment or two with our special guest, Mr. John Perkins. And, of course, at this point, if you're out there, why, we'll be glad to accept your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Ladies and gentlemen, this book is must reading. I can't stress enough, you know, I'm not just trying encourage you to buy books. I really believe it's a very important book. I believe you'll want to get copies of my interviews with Mr. Perkins. You need to get this information. You need to get it out. He's risked a great deal to tell the story. You need to help him disseminate it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Mr. John Perkins. We're talking about the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which is a first-person narrative of the things that go on behind the scenes. So they may not be legally illegal, at least until you get to the point where you have assassinations or revolutions or wars. But all of these things are the alternatives. If the economic hitmen aren't successful, then, as you say, the other jackals are waiting to intervene.
Yes, that's correct.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you know, I think that really, of course, what's happened in Ecuador is really a great tragedy. Maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about Ecuador, because this is a poor country. It was a poor country when you first went there in the late 1960s. And, of course, it's got a lot of oil. It's got a lot of natural resources. And now it's a poorer country than it was, almost 35 years ago.
Yeah, it's sort of typical of what's gone on in so much of the world. And I think it's especially true with countries that are, we'd like to say, blessed with oil, but in fact oil turns out to be a curse for most of these countries. And Ecuador is a good example. Crude was discovered there back in the 30s by Shell Oil Company. But it really, the drilling didn't begin until the late 60s, the early 70s, in that time frame. And Ecuador has actually gotten a lot worse off since oil has been discovered there. And in that case, way, it's very similar to many other, in fact, I dare say all other countries that have oil. Because once it's discovered that oil is in a country, immediately the economic hitmen go to work on that country. We want to make sure that we're going to get the best deal in oil for our oil companies, and so we set about putting our country into deep debt. We set about putting its citizens into deep debt and making them very dependent on us. It's a tale that's been repeated and repeated and repeated. Today, Ecuador owes about 50% of its annual income just to pay off the debt service that we economic hitmen enticed them into taking since the late 60s. You take another country, a country that's very close geographically to Ecuador, that's Venezuela. Also a country with tremendous amounts of oil. In fact, over the decades, it's either been our number three or number four supplier of oil in the United States. It has a population of about 24 million people, and 60% of them are considered destitute, impoverished, and making less than $2 a day. And this in a country that has tremendous amounts of oil.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment with Mr. Perkins. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess this evening, John Perkins, and he was just talking about the country of Ecuador, a small country in South America where, you know, they struck oil back in the early 1960s. They were drilling in the late 1960s, and he points out that, of course, in those days, why they had a debt of about $240 million as a nation. Today, their debt is $16 billion, and the share of national resources allocated to the poorest declined from 20% to 6%. And, of course, the poverty level there, the unemployment increased from 15% to 70%, and the official poverty level grew from 50% to 70% of the population are impoverished with a country that is fabulously wealthy with oil. But, of course, none of that money gets to the common people. And as we intervene, the people don't get better off. They get worse off. And, of course, the rich get richer, the small ruling class get richer. They use the power of the government to oppress the people. And then, of course, when they rise up, we call them terrorists, or we call them communists or something else. Oh, well, the terrible people, they're trying to overthrow the government. And yet every time we put in a democratically elected government, why, of course, we then try to overthrow that government if it doesn't go along with the agenda. We've got Jim calling us from Kansas City. So, Jim, did you have a question or comment?
Yes, sir. It's nice to hear you again, Mr. Perkins. I've heard you on several programs, and I think you might be surprised. Dr. Stan has some very interesting insights on why all those people are allowed to die. But I really wanted to appreciate, or tell you I appreciated, when I saw you on Book TV, that it seemed like the audience that you had were primarily Democrats. And I thought you did a very good job of emphasizing that this goes beyond Democrat, Republican, right, left. I think you'll find Dr. Stan's audience understands that very well.
Okay, basically this is both Democrats and Republican leadership are going along with that. Would that be a fair thing to say, Mr. Perkins?
It's absolutely a fair thing to say. This is not a partisan issue at all, and I appreciate you for calling in with that, Jim, and for enduring so many shows with me. My goodness, you must be getting tired of hearing me, but I appreciate it.
If you have a sore throat, if you have an appearance, you could probably book me, and I could tell many of your stories.
Jim lives in Kansas City, Missouri, so that's, are you listening to us there on the Internet or shortwave?
Internet.
Okay, fine.
Perhaps you could be my double, very much like what Saddam Hussein has, huh?
Right.
Well, I've seen you, and I can't pass for you physically. I cannot pass for you physically, I can tell you that.
Okay, fine. Anything else you wanted to say?
Dr. Stan, I wish you would talk to Mr. Perkins a little bit about your ideas of population control and see how that sounds to him.
All right, well, we don't want to get into that on this program. Perhaps we can talk about it off the air. Right now, I want the people to hear what Mr. Perkins has to say. Everybody out there in the listening audience knows what I feel. Okay, God bless.
Thank you so much,
Jim. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let's go to another Jim. This one's calling from Aptos. So, Jim, Jim in Aptos, did you have a question?
I have two questions.
Speak right up just a little louder, please.
Okay, number one, when the IMF and the World Bank get involved, in many instances, the American people end up as co-signers on the loans, without being told, of course. That's number one. And number two, the publisher that's putting this book out, unless this is a relatively small publisher, I'm surprised a larger publisher would take a chance on publishing this book with this kind of explosive information.
Well, let's talk to Mr. Perkins about that, because you had a little difficulty getting this published,
yes,
didn't you?
Yes, you were very perceptive to bring that up. I talk about it in the preface of the book about a year and a couple of months ago. In fact, I was asked to come to New York to meet with one of the world's largest publishers, the president of that company, who took me out to dinner. He'd read the manuscript and sat with me there in a fine restaurant in New York and said, you know, this is a great book. It's riveting. It's a story that needs to be told, but I can't tell it because I'm owned by an international conglomerate and I might lose my job for telling it. How about fictionalizing it? You could write it like Graham Greene or John le Carré, and then we'd be interested. My literary, in which actually I found very disturbing to think that they would not publish the factual story, but might the fictionalized version. My literary agent, who's excellent, suggested, told me that he felt that probably most major publishers would take that same position, and in fact we get rejections from all the major publishers with very nice letters from many of them saying what a great book it was, but it wasn't quite right for them right at this time. So you're very perceptive in that. And finally, a family-owned publishing company from San Francisco, Barrett Kohler, who publishes great books, primarily business books and alternative business books, books by guys like David Corton, Charlie Derber, and Ted Nace, excellent writers, stepped to the plate and published the book. It's only been out for a little over 2 months, since November 8th. It's, it's number 10 this week on the New York Times bestseller list. It's been on every major bestseller list in the country for a month or more. Its first week out, it went to number one on Amazon. It's doing amazing things. It's in its eighth printing, which tells me that the American people really want to get the story. I'm very encouraged to see that. not for personal reasons so much as because I'm really ecstatic that the American people are interested in this. And as an aside, this might interest you, that president of that publishing company who turned me down a year and a couple of months ago now is falling over himself to get the paperback rights, and all the major publishing companies are putting in very good bids with my publisher to get the paperback rights, and ultimately my current publisher may hold them himself. We're not sure where this is going to go from here, but it tells you a lot about the greed of the corporations and the system that they're willing to take these risks once a book's been proven to be a bestseller.
Well, I think it's an important book. We actually, when we called about 10 days ago, 12 days ago, why they didn't have any at all, but they did have a printing that came in on the 29th of January, and so we have them on the way. We'll have them here in a few days. We think it's an important book, and we want as many people as possible to get the book, to listen to my interviews with Mr. Perkins. In fact, the subject of my newsletter, my January newsletter, is simply my impression of the book, review of the book, and then, of course, talking about Robert McNamara, what he wrote, what Professor Joe Stiglitz wrote, formerly of the World Bank, and, of course, McNamara then, as far as the World Bank is concerned, too, and, of course, the Vice President of the World Bank commented, 10 years after McNamara had been at the World Bank, that the world was far worse off after 10 years. And when I read that in the early 1980s, it just didn't make any sense to me. How could this be happening? After reading Mr. Perkins' book, I know exactly how it's happening. Jim, did you have anything else you wanted to ask?
The other question, of course, is the loans that are being forgiven, somebody ends up paying that, and who is that?
Well, at this point, you're not very many loans have been forgiven. They should be forgiven because most of them have been imposed upon these people without the people's will. In other words, most of these loans have been imposed upon third world countries by dictators in those countries who, in many cases, no longer live there, took a lot of the money themselves and left the country. Those people in those countries really shouldn't have to pay these loans. The banks should pay the loans because they know. And they knew at the time that what they were doing was wrong, that they were giving people loans that couldn't be repaid, or the U.S., the corporatocracy should be responsible for these loans. The last people in the world that should be responsible for them are starving people, people who've been forced into this situation against their own knowledge and will. That's a very unfair system. But up till now, most loans have not been forgiven. There's been a few exceptions. We're talking about forgiving loans in the countries that have been hit with the tsunamis, at least for a short period of time, and then, or at least postponing payment on the debt, not really forgiving the loans. There is discussion right now amongst the G7 countries and the IMF and the World Bank about forgiving loans across the board. I would be completely supportive of that, but this discussion has gone on since the mid-90s, and nothing's ever happened about it in that period of time, so I'm not terribly confident that it will.
Good-sounding sound bites.
All right, I think the other thing is, Jim, remember that with our fiat money system, they create the loans out of nothing. There really is nothing behind the money. No. And so as long as people will take it, why, they can get the money and they can spend it and they can circulate it. But when you can create money out of nothing simply with a bookkeeping entry, I don't think you should be able to force people to repay that loan. I think it's the greatest fraud of all time. Hey, but thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
And the other side of that, if I could...
Go right ahead.
And Jim, is that, you know, if a banker came along and enticed you, Jim, or Dr. Stan, or whoever, into taking a loan, knowing that you couldn't pay it, that you wouldn't be able to pay it, at some point in time, who should be responsible for that loan? Should it be you or should it be the banker? I'd maintain that it should be the banker. He's done some, and in fact, under our court system, it would be the banker. He would be found as criminal. You would get out from under the loan. He would have to pay the penalties. And that's the way it should be on the international scene also. Up until now, it has not been that way, however.
Well, we had Jim calling from Santa Cruz, but Jim has dropped off. If he wants to call back in again, we'll be glad to talk to him. And we had Tim from Indianapolis calling, and Tim has dropped off as well. And now, right now, we have Mike calling. So let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi. As your guest went on talking about the way the IMF and the World Bank operate, I couldn't help but think of the Mafia.
Well, I think it's very, very similar in some respects. How would you comment to a reply to Mike's comment?
Well, yes, that's why we, tongue-in-cheek, called ourselves hitmen, economic hitmen, and kind of after the mafia idea of the hitmen, where the hitmen go out and they arrange for, you know, Joe wants to have a wedding. He wants $20,000, $30,000 for his daughter's wedding, and the Don says, oh, let me give you $50,000, and you can help to open up the new pizza parlor as well as pay for your daughter's wedding. And the Don knows very well that that this guy's not going to be able to repay his loan. So time passes, and interest mounts, and the hitmen go back and say, look, you know, you didn't pay your loan to the Don, so now we got a really big favor to ask of you. And they state it, and they make sure he performs this act for them, he does this favor for them, or they really go after him. And that's very much the way the world economic system is set up. It's an old, old system. It's been going on for hundreds, thousands of years. And the fact is, though, that we, since World War II, have really perfected this system. We've put a whole new slant on it. We've created these organizations like the World Bank and the IMF, which are part of the system. In other words, unlike the Mafia Don, we actually own all the banks that do this, and we print the money. So we've taken it to new levels of sophistication. We're extremely secretive about how we operate. We don't brag. We don't get picked up with microphones, you know, because we're sitting around someplace smoking cigars talking about who we knocked off. That doesn't go on. It's done in a very professional, very secretive way, and it's extremely difficult for anyone to connect the dots who hasn't been on the inside. And even when you're on the inside, it's often difficult to connect the dots.
Now, but the difference between this and the Mafia is the Mafia only beats you up and breaks your legs, you know, because they want you, of course, well, so you can pay the money back. When it comes to this system, why, you can very often get people killed or revolutions or wars. So the Mafia has never been as sophisticated as these people are. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people to know, which is why this is such a very important book. Anything else, Mike?
Well, it seems like the big difference between the IMF and the Mafia is that what the IMF and the World Bank do is legal,
right,
versus what the Mafia normally did was illegal.
Right.
You're exactly right in that, too. The Mafia doesn't get to write the laws.
Right.
We do. And that's a very important point. One of the things I make clear in the book is I don't believe this is a conspiracy. And some people have asked me about the conspiracy theory. Well, a conspiracy, by definition, is a group of people getting together to plot to do something illegal. This definitely is not a conspiracy because it's not illegal.
It's done right out in the open.
Right. But, of course, most people don't know what is going on, and that's why we're doing what we're doing. Hey, thanks for calling,
okay,
Mike. And we've got Tim calling back from Indianapolis, Indiana. Hi, Tim. How are you doing?
Oh, hi, gentlemen. Thank you. I had a couple quick statements and a couple quick questions. At one time, the United States was a sovereign and religious country, but now it seems as though we're attacking religious and sovereign countries. And my questions would be here. Who are the perpetrators doing this exploitation? Would it be England and the U.S., basically?
Well, yeah, there's a number of countries that get involved in this process, but the U.S. is definitely the leader. We're like the quarterback, you know, on a Super Bowl team, and the coach combined. We call the shots, we run the plays, and there's a lot of other people out there doing stuff, or you could say we're like the CEO.
Well, I heard Queen Elizabeth was worth $3 billion, and her worthless son, Prince Charles.
But of course, they get their money from the Central Bank of England. That's where their fortune came from. So,
and my last question.
How much is Bill Gates worth?
Right. Okay. Did you have anything else,
Tim?
Right, sir.
Tim. Well, I make $11 an hour, and I work in an aluminum foundry. Now, how is a little man like me or we? How are we going to bust this global Gestapo up? And I noticed that the crosshairs are focusing on Iran now. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Tim. Do you want to take the reply on the air? I guess Tim's gone. So, well, of course, the question, and I think Tim's question is very, very apropos. What are we going to do? I mean, here he says, I work in an aluminum plant, a foundry. I make $11 an hour. How are we going to oppose them?
Well, you know, it's a very good question and one that comes up frequently. And I think Tim has a lot more power than he realizes he has. We all do. And I'm sure that back in the 1770s, all the people that got together in the taverns to talk about the atrocities committed by King George of England against this country, had exactly the same questions and doubts. What can we do? We're just farmers. We're just fishermen. We're just working in little factories. What can we do? And I know that the blacks had the same questions back when they were trying to get to ride on the same buses as whites in the South. And I'm sure that the people in the Soviet Union had the same question when they were trying to break up the Soviet Union in the 80s. And in fact, the Soviet Union was broken up not by the CIA or the U.S. military, but by a group of labor union leaders and poets and playwrights. History has shown us that when we really have the will and when we band together and give our energies to social movements or civil movements, it works. We overcome tremendous odds. We do destroy places like the Soviet Union, and we do defy the British government. We do clean up rivers that were terribly polluted. We move forward in amazing ways, and that's what's really being called upon us to do at this point in time. And we can look around at a number of situations. For example, Home Depot was accused and boycotted and had strikes imposed on it by Rainforest Action Network and encouraged to have better policies toward rainforest woods. And they buckled. These big corporations buckle when we exert enough pressure on them. We all need to get out there. We need to talk a lot more about this. We need to put our energy behind things that we really believe in, and that should include making this a better world for our children and their children.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment here. And, of course, Mr. Perkins will be with us for the next hour. Those of you out there listening in the state of Washington, you're going to have to get on your Internet and get your shortwave to hear the rest of the program. But we'll be back in just a moment. We'll take Jeannie's question, and then, of course, we'll go to Jim right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Jeannie, did you have a question for our guest? Jeannie, are you there? Is this Jeannie?
This is Jim. Stan.
Okay, hang on there, Jim. We've got to take Jeannie, and then we'll get right to you. Well,
okay.
Go ahead, Jim. What was it you wanted to go ahead?
I wanted to know, Mr. Perkins, if you was aware of the situation in Venezuela.
Right, we're going to be talking about that the next hour, because I think that's very important.
Okay, I'll hang up then.
Okay, Jane, but we will talk about Venezuela next hour, okay?
Yeah, stay on for the next hour.
Okay, fine then. So let's go. Now, I don't know if this is Robert or Jeannie. Is this Robert or Jeannie?
This is Robert.
Okay, Robert, go ahead.
My question is, does that same process as far as Russia with their guaranteed loans from the U.S. and so forth, is it the same set of circumstances, as the other countries?
Okay, fine. Jeannie hung up on us. If she calls back, we'll take her again. What about Russia? Where does Russia fit into this whole thing scenario?
I've never personally worked in Russia, and I hate to speculate. I don't think anything I have to say is anything you can't find in books. You probably know more about Russia than I do. I was very fascinated by how the Russian aristocracy was basically brought down by the labor union leaders and the poets and playwrights and a change of consciousness that really wiped out the Soviet Union. As to what's going on in Russia today, I really can't comment on that. I have no personal experience with that.
Robert, if you would like, I'd suggest you get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which will give you an overview of Russia from the time of the Russian Revolution, the first revolution, the March 1917 revolution, through the October Revolution, and then who it was who financed Russia subsequently. So that, because you'd like to get a copy of the book, 1-800-544-8927. It's called Brotherhood of Darkness, and I think it'll give you tremendous insight and perhaps understanding of what's really going on as far as Russia is concerned. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And so, well, of course, we're going to be then, of course, going on this next hour with Mr. John Perkins. His book, entitled The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is a fascinating insight into what's really going on behind the scenes. And when you realize, of course, that 24,000 people die every single day somewhere in the world because they can't get food, and probably another 25,000 die because they can't get adequate medication, 50,000 people dying every day. In a world, of course, where we have a tremendous accumulation of wealth in the hands of a very small number of people. And, of course, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'll be back just after our concluding remarks here with Mr. John Perkins and his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Mr. John Perkins. If you'd like to know more about his book, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We think this is a very important book. If you'd like to get copies of my interviews with Mr. Perkins, and we actually have three of them. One is 2 hours tonight, and then we have two one-hour interviews with him. It will give you tremendous insight, a little repetition, but every time we talk, certainly I learn additional things about what is really going on in the world today. So, again, our telephone number, if you'd like to know more about the book, 1-800-544-8927. And then if you'd like to get a free copy of our January newsletter, which is my analysis of Mr. Perkins' book, and with the backdrop of what was written about Robert McNamara, what was written about what Professor Stiglitz wrote about his experience when he was vice president of the World Bank, and of course the story is always the same: the people of the rest of the world are being impoverished. Well, how could that happen when we're pouring so much money into these countries? You can only understand after you've read Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And then, of course, for the spiritual aspect of what's going on today, let me suggest that you call our 800 number, as I suggested to Robert, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, because it begins to help you to understand how all of these various government agencies and corporations and banking interests and central banking all tie together, because there is a more or less common denominator, because they want a different type of world than the one we have now. And that world would be really an international empire, no longer led by the United States, but led by a world government with a world parliament, a world military, a world court, a world tax, and that's what the law of the Sea Treaty is all about, and, of course, a massive expansion of international control over the United States. And it would be a wonderful dream if it could be carried out, and we could be certain that the people in charge would be altruistic and righteous. But, unfortunately, when we see what's happening in the world today, and we see some of the terrible things that have been done by the United Nations as far as the corruption there with the oil for food situation for Saddam Hussein, the atrocities carried out by United Nations troops, and then when you really need it, as in a situation in Rwanda, why, of course, orders are given. Stand down. Do not intervene. Do not stop the massacre. And 800,000 predominantly Christians were hacked to death with machetes in Rwanda, while the American government was saying, and Bill Clinton gave the order, don't mention genocide, because if you do, why, we'd have to intervene. And while the Kofi Annan, who at that time was not Secretary General, but of course he was the man in charge of the military, ordered the Canadian general who headed the United Nations troops there. Canadians had enough forces, they could have stopped the slaughter, and they, of course, were told not to intervene. So there are other agendas going on behind the obvious ones, and those of you who have not read my treatise, the Population Control Agenda, why, it's up on my website at RadioLiberty.com. That's the Population Control Agenda, or if you'd like to get a free copy of that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our January newsletter, which is a discussion of Mr. Perkins' book, and then putting this into perspective with the other things we know, the unanswered questions, unanswered until, of course, Mr. Perkins' book came along, then with a first-hand dissertation on, of course, how this system works, how the corporatocracy is using its initial financial power, but then, of course, it's political. It's CIA assassins. How it's using revolutions. How it is certainly using wars to change the structure of the world. So, for those of us you're signing off, why, this is Dr. Stan asking you to pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty, and we'll be back again tomorrow. and we'll be back for the next program. Yeah, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Our guest this evening is Mr. John Perkins. His book is Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and I will promise you that after you've read this book, you'll never look at the world through quite the same eyes again. I believe the book is honest. It certainly goes along with everything I've read and studied, and it explains some of the unanswered questions that really don't make sense, the things that have gone on. After all, when we're giving so much money to these poor countries, why are the majority of the people getting poor? When you read this book, it all makes sense for the first time. Well, we lost Jeannie. If Jeannie would like to call back in, we'd be glad to have her. But right now, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. We have Mike calling in from San Francisco. Hi, Mike. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I do. Hi, John and Dr. Stan. Thanks for having me on tonight. And, John, thanks for the great book and all the wonderful interviews you've been doing.
Have you been hearing him elsewhere?
Yeah, I have been.
Okay, well, I think it's great that they're really getting him out as far as and wide as they are. It's a great message.
Absolutely. And I was visiting John's website, and I see that spirituality has a bearing in his life, and so I was wondering if he could maybe talk a little bit about the shamanism that he's involved in, and also I'd like to find out if ayahuasca had any part in the opening up to shamanism in his life.
Those are really good questions, Mike. And first of all, the work that I did with indigenous people, which started back in my Peace Corps days, back in the late 60s, and I've been working on and off with indigenous people ever since, has been a tremendously eye-opening thing for me. I think it's really can take a lot of the responsibility for ultimately giving me the courage to step forward and write this book. And I think it's also one of the things that allowed me to see the perspective from the poor people's standpoint. And the work I've done on shamanism, the other books I've written, have been five previous books, and they've all been about indigenous wisdom, what we might call shamanism, but also indigenous ecological wisdom and so on. It's been an important part of my life. As to ayahuasca, I don't think I can take too much credit here. I think my experience with ayahuasca has been that it's an amazing plant, and it's kind of an eye-opening plant, but I think there's many, many ways that we can arrive at the same place without using that plant directly.
Is this one of the sort of mind-expanding a herb or plant?
Yeah,
it's an ancient brew that's been around for over 10,000 years, used by the indigenous Indians of South America.
Right. It's used throughout the Amazon extensively, and it's not an illegal substance there. We might in this country call it a hallucinogenic, but they certainly don't see it that way. They see it as helping you face reality. It's a powerful plant, and it's an amazing experience. But I would have to say that my own experience, I think, has come from more of a place where there actually hasn't been any plant involvement. I teach a lot of workshops on these things, or used to, and I still do. I'm doing one this summer at Omega in upstate New York, and certainly we don't use any plants in those ceremonies.
Right.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
Well, no, that will do it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And
bye-bye.
Keep up the great work.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And, of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is John Perkins. And when we get back, well, we'll go ahead and talk a little bit about Venezuela and what's going on there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening is John Perkins, and of course he has an opportunity to meet important people throughout the world, and he's had an opportunity to meet Hugo Chavez, who is the president, the democratically elected president of Venezuela, who is not popular at all in Washington, D.C., because he obviously is concerned about the poor people there. Now, he is probably very left-wing in his relationships. He is actually developing relationships with China and with Fidel Castro, mainly because the American government is intent upon overthrowing his regime. He is democratically elected, and our president, of course, is in favor of democracy as long as we control that democracy. And I really think that would that be a fair statement?
Yes, I think that's a very fair statement, Dr. Stan.
So basically, what's your impression of Chavez? Certainly the tremendous outcry, oh, it was an undemocratic election. We don't like a lot of his policies, and I'm not saying that I like his policies necessarily either, but it certainly seems to be that he's trying to do something for the poor people there. He's subsidizing the bread for them. At least they're not starving to death as they are in other countries. So why don't you discuss what you know about Venezuela?
Well, Venezuela, is one of these countries that seemed to be blessed by oil, but in fact has been cursed by oil. And it went through a huge buying spree based on oil back a couple of decades ago. Went deep into debt. Individuals went into debt, and the country went into debt. And economic hitmen went down and very much encouraged this. And then there was a drop in oil prices, and they couldn't repay their debt. And Venezuela suffered tremendously. And Venezuela had a huge middle class at one time. But as a result of the scenario I just described, the middle class wilted away, and people in the middle class went into the poor classes. Today, it's estimated that about 60% of Venezuela's 24 million people are impoverished, making less than $2 a day. This country that still is our fourth largest supplier of oil in the United States. And so it was a tremendous amount of discontent and anger in Venezuela. And they elected Hugo Chavez as president. And Chavez ran on an anti-American, anti-oil company ticket saying, we want to control our own destiny. We want to make the revenues from the oil. We don't want these things controlled by the United States. And saying, in fact, also that we might stop, that Venezuela might stop supplying oil to the United States and send it instead to China. This was very upsetting to the corporatocracy in the United States. And so we became part of an attempt to overthrow Chavez. Back in April of 2002, a coup was launched against Chavez.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is John Perkins. His book is Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and we were talking about Venezuela, which is the fourth largest supplier of oil in the United States. And yet, of course, with fabulous oil riches there, why this country is impoverished. Why? Because, of course, we went down and got them to take out a lot of loans that they have to spend so much of their money that comes in from the oil revenue simply to pay interest on the loans to the American oil companies. And, of course, the American oil companies forced contracts that are very unfavorable to Venezuela on the Venezuelan government. So Hugo Chavez gets elected as a populist on an anti-American ticket. He gets an overwhelming victory, and he's democratically elected, and we don't like this because, well, of course, he is trying to do something. They've got 60% of their people who live in poverty. The middle class has been wiped out. A lot of people who in the past really were living comfortable lives in this very, very prosperous country are now themselves impoverished. And, of course, we're now doing everything to overthrow Chavez. There was recently a very concerted effort to have another election. And, of course, Jimmy Carter went down to supervise this. And Jimmy Carter said the election was fair, but we're insisting it was corrupt, it was wrong, even though the vast majority of the people who voted for Hugo Chavez, because it at least offers them hope. Whereas the invested ruling class doesn't want that. They want to maintain their power. And so you have this class struggle going on there. But since we, of course, say, well, we're in favor of democracy, how can we then oppose the will of the people? Mr. Perkins.
Well, it's a very good question, Dr. Stan. And I think it reaches to the very heart of what we've been talking about here tonight. Incidentally, I just got back last week. I was in Brazil at the World Social Forum giving a keynote address there, and Hugo Chavez was also there giving a keynote. And I found the 150,000 people attending, a tremendous backlash against the United States policy, not against us as individuals. People were very supportive of the work I'm doing. They're very supportive of Chavez. He's making quite a lot of waves in South America. People really respect the fact that he is standing up to the U.S. government. And, for us now to go in, it's interesting. Actually, it was in April of 2002 that we participated in the coup against Chavez, and by we I mean the economic hitmen, the jackals, our government, our corporatocracy. At about that same time, we were preparing to go to war with Iraq, and in order to defend democracy, we said. But while we're talking about defending democracy in Iraq, we're trying to overthrow a democratically elected president of Venezuela. Figure that one out.
Well, of course, you say one thing, you do another, and then you get support from both sides.
Right.
Well, of course, what's really happening, the establishment here in the United States wants to establish the free trade zone of the Americas, which is really to tear down all trade barriers, and I think it's just as in Europe, it's the first step towards consolidating the economies, consolidating a currency, and then, of course, having a supranational government, which we will dominate, just as in Europe, why the supranational government of all of Europe is really controlled by Germany and France. So the ultimate goal would be to have this government of the Western Hemisphere controlled by the United States. And that, of course, is the goal of the what you would call the corporatocracy. I would call it the American establishment. Doesn't matter what we call it. It's the same entity. And but it looks like what is happening today is going to throw a monkey wrench into that. In fact, Brazil and Argentina and certainly Venezuela and many of the countries of South America are not going along with this, are they?
Well, you're quite correct. There's actually a rebellion happening in Latin America against the very things we've talked about, against this debt that we've imposed upon them and against our policies. In fact, in the last elections, in six countries, the presidential candidate who ran on an anti-U.S., anti-corporate globalization ticket won in addition to the three you mentioned, Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, and Ecuador all voted for the candidate who opposed U.S. corporate policy. And a number of these countries are really standing up to us. We've talked a bit about Venezuela. Lula, the president of Brazil, is doing something similar. Kirchner, the president of Argentina, has in fact said that his country will not pay more than 3% of its annual revenues to buy down the debt that's been imposed on that country. And he's defaulted massively on some of these loans and said, you know, we're just not going to pay these loans. They're illegal loans. They never should have been forced upon us. He says, yeah, our leaders shouldn't have accepted them, but our leaders were puppets of U.S. Government. Those leaders are gone now. The people are stuck with these loans that they had nothing to do with and didn't benefit from, and we're not going to pay them.
Well, let's go to Jeannie, who's calling from Aptos. Hi, Jeannie. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, I have many questions. Number one, Hugo Chavez. The poor people are very upset with him because he promised them a lot of things, like cement to build their houses, and he has reneged on that. And he has changed the Constitution, and he's more like a dictator now. For this Mr. Perkins to say that this guy is on the good side and helping the poor people, that is not true.
All right, well, let's get Mr. Perkins' response to that.
Well, I'm not sure where you're getting your information from, but the fact of the matter is there was a referendum in Venezuela not long ago, and Hugo Chavez won it by a very considerable majority of the voters.
And I have friends, and I live in Central America, and I have friends in Venezuela. And you've got to remember, Hugo Chavez, before he was elected democratically, he actually did a coup himself on the government. And so he is not has a clean slate. And by the way...
Go ahead, but do you have a question at all, Jeannie?
Well, it just infuriates me that someone should come on the radio and just say Hugo Chavez is doing great things for the poor people, and Dr. Stan, that is not so.
All right, fine. Do you have a question?
Well, Jeannie, I never said that, and I have a lot of problems with Hugo Chavez's policies. I don't think he's doing a great job for Venezuela necessarily, but he is democratically elected.
Yeah, and I have friends in Venezuela that it was a fraud. And Dr. Stan, you said Jimmy Carter went down there to see if the election went okay. Well, you know, Jimmy Carter removed Somoza out of Nicaragua, and he removed the Shah of Iran. So Jimmy Carter has no credibility with me.
Okay, fine. Did you have a question at all, Jimmy?
Yeah, I'm going to go to the World Bank. Reading some notes on that, the World Bank does say there's no economic solution. It's right there, I'm looking at it right now, for the debt that the third world countries have taken on. And so it wasn't clear to me in the last hour, do the American taxpayers, when a debt is forgiven of a third world country, do they take up that debt?
All right. What actually happens when? Let's imagine the World Bank or the IMF suddenly forgive a debt. I don't think they're forgiving very many of them. Let's imagine, for instance, with Argentina, they're just not going to pay the debt. Then what happens to that debt, from your point of view, Mr. Perkins?
Well, most of the loans that are given out by the World Bank and the IMF come from the international money market. So they're essentially bought down on the money market, the same as any bank gets its money. So, you know, conceivably, if the system really worked itself out, you could say that these would be the demise of the World Bank and the IMF. They would no longer be able to get money on the international money market. It's not from the American taxpayer in that case. Many of the grants come from the American taxpayers, and U.S. foreign aid under the U.S. Agency for International Development comes from the taxpayer. But most of the World Bank IMF money does not. Now, if a policy was set by the G7 countries along with the IMF and the World Bank to forgive this debt, then we would implement systems to handle that. It's not been done yet, so we don't really have a precedent, and it's impossible for me to speculate exactly how that system would be structured and whether it would affect the U.S. taxpayers or not. I'm not sure, but it would be a very small cut to American taxpayers relative to our overall budget. I'm sure if that were to happen, it would be done over a period of time.
Well, I feel we should have to pay any money to the IMF, which we put out about, Dr. Stan, about 25%?
Well, we actually fund the IMF, so
yes.
If they, of course, lose money, why, I'm sure our leaders will go ahead and give them more money, because all they do is just simply make a bookkeeping entry and put it in. But what's so interesting, of course, is what Argentina's debt was. Argentina's debt had been circulated by major European financial houses and sold to a lot of retirees in Italy. And so a lot of these people were getting 10% interest on their money. And, of course, it was, of course, to be paid back in pesos, which was tied to the American dollar. So there was just no way they could lose because the Argentine government pegged the peso to the dollar. The only trouble was the Argentine government reneged on their promise. They broke the tie to the dollar. They devalued the peso 70%. And then they told the people that pay them back 20 cents on the dollar that they didn't like it, they wouldn't get anything. And what they've done is end up impoverishing a lot of people over in Italy. Thank goodness it's not Americans, but still, those people's whole life savings, many of them have been destroyed by the default on the debt there, by Argentina's default. And yet I don't blame the Argentine government for defaulting because this debt was forced on them, I believe, from outside sources.
I have two more questions, Doc.
Okay, do you want to hang on there for just a moment? Okay, we'll be back in just a moment with Mr. John Perkins. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we'll be back in just a moment. Our guest is the author of the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And Mr. Perkins has said on other programs he doesn't agree with many of Hugo Chavez's policies, but there's a real problem there in Venezuela. And certainly the previous governments were not dealing with the lot of the poor and impoverished. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. John Perkins. Jeannie, do you have another question?
I have a remark of what you just said before you went on the break.
Right.
The previous government in Venezuela, they had a big middle class, and business was doing quite well until Hugo Chavez came in and changed the constitution, higher taxes for the business. So he's the actual one that's decimating the middle class. So that was my retort to you, Dr. Stan.
Okay, go ahead.
I have two questions. The World Bank has a private sector investment arm called the International Finance Corporation. Mr. Perkins, could you talk about that and what its responsibility and what it does?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Jeannie, but I would like to comment a little bit on what you just said about Venezuela. I also have very good friends who own big businesses in Venezuela, are not at all happy with Chavez. However, the fact of the matter is that under the previous presidency that you talk about, the middle class dropped tremendously. Today, the statistics show that 60% of the people of Venezuela are officially impoverished, making less than $2 a day. I mean, that happened before Chavez came in. And the real fact of the matter here is that the poor people have a very strong rebellion going in Venezuela, and they have elected him, and that is my point. I don't think that he's doing a particularly good job in many respects, but the fact of the matter is he's democratically elected, and it really isn't.
The election was a fraud.
Well, so was a lot of the elections in Chicago. Should we have a revolution in Chicago?
Irrelevant, Dr. Stan. Okay.
And we don't really know that the election was a fraud. I mean,
yes, it was because people had to stand in line for hours and they never got to vote.
But that's exactly the same thing that happened in the Democratic areas of Ohio, Jeannie. They did not have enough votes, ballots in many of the areas in Ohio for areas that they knew were going to vote for John Kerry. And as you know, I despise John Kerry. But we have fraudulent elections here.
We have fraudulent in the United States and in Venezuela. The difference?
All right, go ahead. Let's go ahead. And anything else you want to say,
Jeannie? Well, your other question, Jeannie, was that about the International Finance Corporation or the International Development Association?
No, International Finance Corporation.
Okay. It was founded in, I think it was 1956, to invest in or make loans to private companies operating in borrowing countries that wanted to borrow from the World Bank. And it's an organization that under its charter must make a profit. And it, therefore, it's almost kind of rigged not to be able to benefit the poorest directly. 85% of the money from the IFC goes into the 15 countries, the ones that could attract investment on the international markets anyway. In my opinion, the IFC has always been a bit of a sham that's set up basically to help people be able to invest in countries that are pretty risk-free and do this under the guise of providing economic aid to these countries, and in fact, that does not do any work in the countries that need the help the most.
Well, how does the Global Environment Facility work with this? Do they have a working relationship?
I don't quite know what you mean, Jeannie.
Well, Mr. Perkins knows. Global Environment Facility.
I'm not familiar with it.
Okay.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks so much.
No, I have one more question, Dr.
Okay, hold on. Well, this is Dr. Stad back here at Radio Liberty. Jeannie has one more question. What's the question?
Yeah, this is important. Mr. Perkins, what do you feel should be done with the World Bank, the IMF, and the Bretton Woods Agreement?
Those two, IMF and World Bank, came out of the Bretton Woods Agreement.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts at all on how we can get this system to be honest? Because obviously this represents it's constructed for the benefit of the corporatocracy.
Well, I'm all in favor of foreign aid, and we really need to help these struggling countries to be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. As we mentioned several times on this program, over 50,000 people are dying needlessly every single day. This doesn't need to happen. And foreign aid can go a long way to solving those problems.
But how do you keep it from being transferred from the poor people in a rich country to the rich people in a poor country?
You know, we need to set up systems that will make sure it gets directed to helping the poor, to helping the small fisherman, the small farmer, the small entrepreneur, instead of the big businesses.
And how do we do that?
That is, of course, the $64,000 question, because every year they're going to regroup it, they're going to redo it, and every year, things, as you point out, get worse and worse.
Well, we've had tremendous success in the nonprofit world. I've been very involved in that with microbanking, for example, throughout the world. It's been an incredibly successful program.
But that's been a private program. It has not been a government program.
Well, and there's no reason why things like the World Bank couldn't be restructured to support those kinds of organizations.
Well,
the work that I did in Panama, that Omar Torrijos basically forced us to do there, to help the poor people, was done through World Bank and Inter-American Development Bank financing. We created some amazingly wonderful projects in Panama that reached the rural poor, that reached the small farmer, the small fishermen, small industrialist entrepreneurs. It was very, very successful.
But then they killed him.
That's right.
So, thanks. Anything else?
Yeah, I'm not for foreign aid. It's what's happening in the third world countries. They're taking away their property, putting higher taxes up, and the World Bank and the Rockefellers are coming in and taking all the land. Lot of these things that this man is espousing is actually coming out of the United Nations treaties. And I have a real concern about this, Dr.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Jeannie. Yeah. Let's go to Nathan, calling from Contra Costa. Nathan, does you have a question?
Well, good evening. Yes, I don't mean to intrude too much into the conversation, but I just am going to cite, previously a caller mentioned the Rockefellers as leaders of this movement towards a global corporatocracy, and I have in my hands right now the memoirs of David Rockefeller, his book.
Isn't that fascinating when you find David Fidel Castro going to meet David Rockefeller?
Well, on page 437 to 438, he discusses free trade through fast track. He makes a very interesting statement. I won't read the whole sentence because it's rather long, but he says that when President Bush came into the White House, again, I'm reading at the bottom of page 437 and I'm going into 438, he was eventually able to get in fast track. While Clinton insisted on, the Democrats insisted on unrealistic labor and environmental standards, quote unquote, the Bush White House managed to get in fast track, which Congress could then accept by a simple majority vote rather than the two-thirds majority required by the Constitution. So I'm roughly paraphrasing the sentence. You can read it yourself. He blatantly states the Constitution is going to be replaced by some other system in which fast-track agreements can be just sort of rushed through Congress. Now, that leads, that opens up a whole question box there. If in his memoirs he could blatantly state that our Constitution is archaic, it's outmoded, what we need is this new sort of corporate Constitution, how much more behind the scenes do they not only heap scorn on the constitutions of such nations as Venezuela or Haiti, but also on our own Constitution here in the United States? And I will take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, fine. Do you have any comment on that at all, Mr. Perkins?
Well, no, I don't think I probably know any more about this than our listener who called in, frankly.
Well, I think that, of course, the whole idea, Nathan, is that if you have a treaty, why you have to have a two-thirds majority? If you have a simple trade agreement, why you can do it with a simple majority, you don't have to have two-thirds. And, of course, the last thing that they want is, you know, is any opposition to their plan. They have a globalist plan. They would like to bring all of the Western Hemisphere under the control of this ruling elite here, and then, I believe, eventually, of course, unite them into a world government. But they're doing it step by step. The Constitution is simply an impediment. If you read the article in Foreign Affairs magazine in April of 1974, Mr. Richard Gardner talks about, of course, how we have to do an end run around the Constitution. That's April of 1977, Foreign Affairs magazine, well worthwhile reading. We've got to do an end run around the Constitution, because that's how we're going to arrive at the New World Order. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Mr. John Perkins. His book is must reading. It's Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and it certainly gives you tremendous insight into how things work behind the scenes. And we have a Jim back on from Santa Cruz. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Jim, is this the same Jim who called in before?
Yeah, I hung up a couple times back for a couple different reasons.
Well, did you hear the discussion on what's going on in Venezuela?
Yes, I have.
All right, fine.
And I wanted to ask a question. I wanted to know, Mr. Perkins, if you was aware of a recent news story where Chavez is now giving away land that's owned by multinational corporations. He's just flat out giving it away.
Well, he can't give it away. He's got to seize it first.
Yeah. Well, he's telling, as I understand the story, and I may have misunderstood it, but he's allowing peasants to just go ahead and move on to corporate-held land and just, you know, take it, build houses on it.
Of course, this is what they're doing in Mugabe's Rhodesia, Zimbabwe today. This is a standard, Marxist approach, seizing land without compensating people for it. Are you aware of this program that's going on there?
You know, I have not been there in Venezuela personally for a few years, so I'm not personally familiar with it. I've read about what's going on, but I really don't know any more about it than what I read from other people.
What I'm hearing, Jim, is that they are basically, of course, seizing and nationalizing some of the large land holdings there, which, of course, is not right. You take away, you don't give everybody freedom by taking a property away from others, one group. You can buy it from them, and you certainly should, the land that you have. But then, of course, when you give people land, well, they're not going to use it properly. I mean, there's one thing about an agrarian program, but when you seize land from one person, give it to another, you're simply buying their votes, and this is absolutely wrong. And many of the policies that they're invoking there really are extremely Marxist or socialist, or call it communistic if you will. And the question is, what is the solution? We're driving, we're doing everything we can to drive Hugo Chavez right into the arms of the communist Chinese, the arms of the of Fidel Castro. But did it ever occur to you that maybe this whole thing is a scam? Once again, we have the dialects, the two forces in opposition to one another. You play both sides against the middle. Well, Jim, did you have another question for our guest?
That's basically it. I just wanted to add, you know, that I think that this situation is going to, you know, it's going to lead to an escalation of tensions with the U.S. government.
Well, there already is talk about a war being launched by Colombia, a breaking relationship between Colombia and Venezuela, as a prelude to another war that would be fought there. But it won't be American troops, it'll be Colombian troops. But this is the way that affairs are handled. If you've got a man who's out of control and isn't going along with the system, why you go to war with him?
I'm afraid that it's going to be Chile all over again, like in the early 70s under Allende. The CIA is going to orchestrate some kind of coup down there, and a lot of people are going to get murdered.
Well,
that's
would you like to comment
about
on that, Mr. Perkins? Are you concerned that this might be another episode as we saw in Guatemala or in Ecuador or in Chile or in Peru?
Chile. Well, I think that's entirely possible. That's what happens when the jackals step in, when the economic hitmen fail, and that seems to be what's happening. I think the greatest reason why that wouldn't happen now, why that might not happen now, is because we're so extended in the Middle East, and that seems to be our highest priority right now. And one of the important things to remember about the Middle East is that China gets most of its oil from the Middle East. We don't get most of our oil from there. We get more from Venezuela and from this hemisphere. But if we can control Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and a pipeline coming down from the Caspian area through Afghanistan, we've essentially controlled all the energy supplies or the majority of the energy supplies for China, Japan, and Korea. And I think as we look forward into the next decade, that's a very important objective for us. Therefore, we are very committed in the Middle East, which offers a certain amount of protection to many of these other countries, particularly those in our own backyard in Latin America.
Okay, Jim, does that answer your question?
Yeah. Could I make one last comment before I hang up?
Sure, go ahead.
You know, I don't agree with a lot of what Chavez stands for, but I think his actions call attention to a very real problem.
And I think you're right, and I certainly don't agree with much of what he's doing either. But we have real problems, and how should we address them? Are we addressing them in the right way?
Yeah, we're a republic, not an empire.
God bless. Thanks, Jim. Okay. Let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Jack, did you have a question for our guest?
Well, segueing from the previous caller, Chalmers Johnson wrote a book, Sorrows of Empire. And I saw the interview where he adamantly insisted that the CIA, as JFK wanted to do, be dismantled into 1,000 pieces and scattered into the wind. What I see going on in Iraq, and your guest can correct me if he'd like to, but I see another genocidal police action being prosecuted by none other than the Central Intelligence Agency all over again. And what's the bounty here? Well, we got the oil pipeline in the works. And we got a drug, the opium, being cultivated now thanks to the United States State Department, Colin Powell, et al. So I'm just wondering if all these people are onto something here, and whether the guest, Mr. Perkins, wouldn't like to write a book about the need for terminating the CIA.
Well, that would have to be his decision. He's really, of course, his book, a great strength is that he is actually telling us his personal experiences working as an economic hitman, working for the corporatocracy. So certainly I don't think he would be an expert on what's going on over in Iraq, although would you like to comment on your view of Iraq today, from at least from your past experience, working for the corporatocracy?
Well, as I think we talked about previously on the program, Pakistan, what happened in Iraq was a direct result of the failure on the part of economic hitmen to bring Iraq around in the way that we brought Saudi Arabia around in the 70s. That's really the crux of why we went into Iraq, in my opinion. It had nothing to do with democracy. It had everything to do with oil and with construction, constructing a country. The CIA, now that's a very interesting one. I've certainly been very familiar with the CIA and some of its jackals. I still have a few friends amongst the jackals, most of whom are in Iraq today. The CIA certainly is in turmoil, and the administration seems to be determined to tear it down and to replace it with the Pentagon. And one of the interesting aspects of that is that covert actions under the Pentagon fall under the jurisdiction of the executive branch of government, while as oversight of the CIA, theoretically at least, rests with Congress. So if you move from the CIA to the Pentagon, if you move more covert activities from the CIA to the Pentagon, you've essentially taken them out of the control of the Congress.
In other words, no longer are they answerable to our duly elected representatives. They're answerable only to the president. And, of course, if you can run both political candidates for president, why, the American people really don't have much choice. That would be my opinion.
That's correct.
All right.
Now, of course, I don't think that the Congress actually has a heck of a lot of control over the CIA either, but at least on paper it does.
And I think that's a very real factor, and this is really rather frightening to me, Jack, that this is going on and there's no outcry from the American people, because once intelligence is with the military, and now increasingly we find the military being used in violation of the Posse Comitatus lies against the American people, and we find out that, of course, in total violation of the Posse Comitatus, there were thousands of military forces guarding the president during the inauguration. I think the president needs to be guarded, but not by the United States military, because the military was never to be used for any domestic purposes.
Well, Dr. Stan, and that, of course, segues back to Colonel Dan Marvin, your interview with him. But I would like to ask the guest further, since his forte is economics, why in the world would James Traficant out of Ohio, who made an eloquent dissertation on the world's greatest bankruptcy of all history, that of the United States government. And then when I looked into the term United States in Black's Law Dictionary, it was deleted in the 7th edition as well as the current 8th edition. So it sounds like the good old corporate United States, as Mr. Traficant had delineated, is bankrupted, and maybe FDR, with his HJR 192 or executive orders banning the private ownership of gold as money, is testament to that. And I'd like his comments on that.
Okay, fine. Thanks, Jack. I don't know. Would you want to comment at all upon what Jack was saying?
Well, I don't think I have much insight that I could add to that. It's not in my realm of personal experience, frankly.
All right, fine. I think that that's a very, very fair question. I think that the strength of course, your writing and the strength of your interviews is dealing with things that you know a great deal about, and I'm sure Jack knows far more about what he was talking about. I would just comment, Jack, you better be careful, because you know what happened to Congressman Traficant. He will be in prison for many, many years. They engineered, they had FBI informants in his office. They spent 6 years building up a case to convict him and throw him in prison. When, of course, you are in Congress, it doesn't pay to speak out against the powers that be, or you'll end up like Congressman George Hansen. You'll end up like, of course, Congressman Traficant. You'll end up like Senator Wellstone. You'll end up like Senator Tower. You'll end up like Congressman Hale Boggs. You'll end up like, well, Senator Imhoff was lucky. It was just the propeller fell off of his airplane after he had made some very forceful statements about some of the government policies. So anyway, Jack, there's a great deal of truth in what you say, but this is a little beyond what we're talking about this evening. Our guest, of course, is John Perkins. His book is Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We're here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And if you read, of course, the section on Saddam Hussein, it really is very well put. And, of course, Mr. Perkins talks about Saddam Hussein and the fact, and let me just read you what he said. It hardly mattered that he, Saddam, was a pathological tyrant, that he had bloods of mass murders on his hands, or that his mannerisms and brutal actions conjured images of Adolf Hitler. The United States had tolerated and even supported such men many times before. We would be happy to offer him U.S. government securities in exchange for petrodollars, as long as the promise of the continued oil supplies was there, and for a deal whereby the interest on those securities would be used to hire U.S. companies to improve infrastructure systems throughout Iraq, to create new cities and to turn the deserts into oases. By the late 1980s, it was apparent that Saddam was not buying into the economic hitman scenario. This was a major frustration and great embarrassment to the first Bush administration. As George W. Bush searched for a way out, Saddam played into his hands. He invaded the oil-rich sheikdom of Kuwait. Now, your suggesting is that this is actually the sort of deal we worked out with Saudi Arabia. The desert oases bloomed. We built up their infrastructure. But in so doing, we impoverished the people there. And actually, I remember reading recently where about 50 to 60% of the country is Shia Muslim. And their income had fallen to almost a third of it was maybe 20 years ago. How, with the tremendous wealth of Saudi Arabia, could the wealth of a large segment of the population be actually falling when it appears that that country is so wealthy?
Well, isn't that interesting, Dr. Stan, that like so many countries, like every country that's been burdened with oil, Saudi Arabia has actually suffered from this tremendous amount of oil it has. And the people there are extremely unhappy today. There's a lot of assassinations. There's terrorism. I wouldn't be surprised, but what Saudi Arabia is another country where we're going to find ourselves having to send in troops one day, because we've guaranteed the continuation of the House of Saud as long as they provide oil prices that are in limits that are acceptable to us. And in order to uphold that agreement with the House of Saud, I think it's very possible that in the near future we may have to take military actions, because they're very, very unpopular. They're not only unpopular among Saudis, but among many Arabs, and in fact among Muslims around the world, because they've as part of their deal with us back in the 70s, they hired American companies to westernize their country. So now you have the most sacred sites in Islam, Mecca and Medina, essentially surrounded by, Americanized institutions like McDonald's.
Well, my understanding is that a great deal of the money that the Sauds got from selling oil to us was then reinvested in the United States in our various corporate enterprises. Is that right?
Well, that's the deal that we struck, exactly. Back in the early 1970s, as you may recall, as I'm sure you do recall, Saudi Arabia and OPEC essentially brought us to our knees. We had long lines at the gas stations. We were afraid we were going to have another depression like that of 1929. And at that point, the Treasury Department came to me and other economic hitmen and said, listen, what can you do? What kind of a plan can you devise to make sure this never happens again? And to make the long story short, and the longer versions in the book, we knew that Saudi Arabia was the key, because it had more oil than any other country in the world, and the House of Saud, the royal family, was corruptible. So we worked out this deal whereby the House of Saud would agree to send most of its petrodollars, most of the money it earned on its oil exports, back to the United States to invest in U.S. government securities. The interest from those securities would be used by the Treasury Department to hire U.S. companies to build up Saudi Arabia, build entire cities out of the desert, build salinization plants and power plants and highways and ports and all kinds of infrastructure that was very westernized. And as a part of this deal, the House of Saud would guarantee oil prices would stay within limits acceptable to us, and we would guarantee the continuation of the House of Saud as the family that would run the country. So that was a deal that we struck back in the 70s, and it's continued ever since. It's the same type of deal that we then tried to strike with Saddam Hussein in the 80s, but he didn't buy into the deal for whatever reason. I never understood. And in the 80s, we also sent in the Jackals to try to assassinate him. They couldn't. His security forces were too good. And so we sent in the troops as a last resort in 1990. After that, we actually wanted to keep Saddam in power. He was a strong leader. He could control his people. We thought that if we could destroy his army, his military, and keep him in power, we'd have the best of all worlds, and he'd be sufficiently chastised so that now the economic hitman could go back in the 90s and bring him around. They tried. We tried. Couldn't. We failed once again. The jackals went back in, failed again, so the military went back in for a second time.
And so that's why we're war in Iraq. And I really think that this is exactly what it's all about. And the tragedy is that the American people are not being told the truth. We're being told, oh, we had to attack him. After all, he was about ready to attack us. He had weapons of mass destruction when they didn't turn him. Well, he was working with Al-Qaeda, but the trouble was that Saddam had outlawed Al-Qaeda because he was afraid of this radical form of Islam for fear to be used against him. So then we came up with, well, the real reason we went there is the world better off without Saddam Hussein? I mean, after all, shouldn't we want to bring democracy to the Middle East? Aren't we better off fighting terrorism on the streets of Baghdad than on the streets of New York? Now, all of those scenes sound so rational, and none of them are accurate. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. You know, I think it's really such a tragic thing that the American boys and girls who are over there fighting, and many of them are dying or being wounded, or many of them will never be the same again because of the psychological trauma or the other diseases they're coming down with. I really think that the terrible thing is that the average young person has no idea what this war is all about. As with so many wars, they're fought for far different reasons than the young men and women who fight them are allowed to know. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, absolutely fair. It's totally tragic. I feel very, very sorry for the people that are fighting over there, because I think they're risking their lives for a cause that they believe in, but it isn't the true cause of why we're actually there, in my opinion, and based upon my experience.
And, of course, this is a recurrent pattern, and, of course, if you read the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, Mr. Perkins tells how this is a standard technique. First of all, the economic hitmen go in. If they can't be successful, the assassins go in. If they're not successful, then you have a revolution. If that's not successful, you have a war. It's sort of a progressive increase of pressure to bring that country into power. Because when you have the amount of power that the United States does, why that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And unfortunately, why that power, I feel, is being misused throughout the world. But there is coming a day of justice, and if we don't take a position to remedy this situation, I truly fear for my country. We'll be back to wrap up this evening's program with Mr. John Perkins. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Mr. John Perkins. And, you know, I know that you feel as deeply about the idealism that once established this country as I do. And you talked about, really, of course, how it was during the Revolutionary period when people were willing to take a stand and risk their lives for this nebulous concept of freedom and liberty.
Yeah, it's interesting. If we look back at history, Dr. Stan, and see that people like George Washington and the Founding Fathers really stuck their heads in the noose. They went up against the most powerful nation in the world. They must have asked many of the questions that we're asking today, like how can we possibly defeat the British Empire? Certainly there were a lot of naysayers at that time, what we now call the Tories, and people that opposed these movements. The Boston Tea Party was very unpopular among many people. But these Founding Fathers had great courage, and they stood up for what they believed in. Had they lost the revolution, every one of them would have been hanged, and I think sometimes we forget that. I believe we're at a time in history that very much resembles that time in many respects. Certainly technology's changed, the way we live has changed, but a lot of the philosophy, a lot of the struggle that's behind all this is similar. But the problem is that we now have become that empire that we fought against, and so we need to do that once again. And we also need to remember that the empire we fought against before was us. We were British citizens. George Washington and the Founding Fathers were all citizens of England, and they were fighting against themselves very much for what we're called upon to do today. It's time that we once again exercise that sort of courage. It's time that we once again establish that we really are about establishing governments for the people, of the people, by the people, not for the corporations, of the corporations and by the corporations, or of the rich for the rich and by the rich. Hello? Hello?
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I think that people really have to get involved. They have to commit themselves. We have to educate the people. Only an awakened and concerned American people are ever going to be able to turn us away from what I believe is, of course, a path to ultimate destruction. Mr. Perkins, I want to thank you very much for being with us. This is, the third interview, and I guess the last one will do for the time being anyway. And I'm looking forward to your next book.
Well, thank you. Yeah, being on your show, Dr. Stan, and being out there talking to people across the country has been very, very enlightening for me, very educational, very inspirational. I've learned that people have a lot of questions. I want to dig deep in and find some more answers, and I will come out with that other book. That probably won't be for a year or two. I really want to thank you for all the incredible work you're doing in helping to educate the American public.
Thank you so very much. Good night.
Good night.
All right, well, I guess this evening has been Mr. John Perkins, and as I read his book, I was reminded of a poem I learned when I was in a junior high. It was written by Sir Walter Scott. Breathes there the man with soul so dead, who never to himself hath said, "This is mine own, my native land," whose heart hath ne'er within him burned as homeward his footsteps he hath turned from wandering on a native strand. If such there breathe, go mark him well. For him no minstrel of raptures swell. High though his title, proud his name, boundless his wealth as wish can claim. Despite those titles, power and pelf, the wretch concerted all in self. Living shall forfeit fair renown, and doubly dying shall go down to the vile dust from whence he sprung, unwept, unhonored, and unsung. And, you know, I believe in America. I believe in the promise of America. And I believe that that promise has been forgotten. And it has been betrayed by the group I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, which, of course, is working behind the scenes and energized by dark and sinister spiritual forces, pretty forces of organized evil. And that is certainly laid out well in my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which I hope many of you want to get. Of course, if you'd like to get the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, why, we will have those in the next day or so. And then we're putting together a four-tape set of my interviews with Mr. Perkins. And, of course, we have 3 hours of interviews with him, and then 2 half-hour interviews I did for our Saturday program, as I try to put this whole incredible scenario into perspective and help you understand the true nature of the organized evil we face today. If we can't convince the American people of what's going on, then nothing will change, and America as a nation will be destroyed, for there's no incidence in all history when a nation has turned to empire, has turned to a fiat money system, has turned to moral depravity, where that nation has not eventually fallen. There's no incident in all history where a nation has turned against God, where that nation has not been brought under God's judgment. And I fear for this country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. So we do hope that if you'd like to get more information on our ministry, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We offer, of course, the book, Confessions of a Hitman, Economic Hitman, the four-tape set of interviews with John Perkins, and we'll call that Confessions of an Economic Hitman. If you'd like a free copy of my January newsletter, which deals almost exclusively with this incredible story of Mr. Perkins, and then putting into perspective of what, of course, Major General Smedley Butler said about war being a racket. He, of course, was one of the most highly decorated military men of all time, with 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, and had fought in dozens of campaigns, besides, of course, the First World War. And he eventually wrote a book. It was called War is a Racket. And he pointed out that all of the wars are rackets, and the men who fight and bleed and suffer and die in the wars never understand what they're about. And we cover his writings and, of course, the article written in Foreign Affairs magazine about McNamara's 10-year tenure at the World Bank, and then, of course, Professor Stiglitz's book, Globalism and Its Detractors, and both of those stories tell about how, of course, the World Bank and its activities is designed to impoverish people. And you can understand this by understanding that there really are dark forces in the world today. There really are satanic forces. If you've never heard the videos, they sold their souls for rock and roll. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version, they sold their souls for rock and roll. Or Megiddo Part 1, or Megiddo Part 2, very professionally done analyses of what's happening today from the spiritual point of view. You need to get them. And then pray for America. Pray for revival. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.